Chapter 79. Which Clemens gives him, originated when Oliver Herford, whose quaint wit has so long delighted New Yorkers, one day pinned up by the back door of the Players the notice : exit in case of Simmons. Gwen, a popular novel of that day, was written by Blanche Willis Howard. Amy Dodge, in the next letter, was the son of Mrs. Mary Mapes Dodge, editor of St. Nicholas. To Clara Clemens, in Paris. Mr. Rogers' office, February 5, 94. Dear Benny, I was intending to answer your letter today, but I am away downtown, and will simply whirl together a sentence or two for good-fellowship. I have bought photographs of Coquelin and Jane Hayden, and will ask them to sign them. I shall meet Coquelin tomorrow night, and if Hayden is not present I will send her picture to her by somebody. I am to breakfast with Madame Nordica in a few days, and meantime I hope to get a good picture of her to sign. She was of the breakfast company yesterday, but the picture of herself which she signed and gave me does not do her majestic beauty justice. I am too busy to attend to the photo collecting right, because I have to live up to the name which Jamie Dodge has given me, the Elle of New York, and it just keeps me rushing. Yesterday I had engagements to breakfast at noon, dine at 3, and dine again at 7. I got away from the long breakfast at 2 p.m., went and excused myself from the 3 o'clock dinner, then lunched with Mrs. Dodge in 58th Street, returned to the Players and dressed, dined out at 9, and was back at Mrs. Dodge's at 10 p.m., where we had magic lantern views of a superb sort, and a lot of yarns until an hour after midnight, and got to bed at 2 this morning, a good deal of a gain on my recent hours. But I don't get tired. I sleep as sound as a dead person, and always wake up fresh and strong, usually at exactly 9. I was at breakfast lately, where people of 7 separate nationalities sat, and the 7 languages were going all the time. At my side, sat a charming gentleman who was a delightful and active talker, and interesting. He talked glibly to those folks in all those 7 languages, and still had a language to spare. I wanted to kill him, for very envy. I greet you with love and kisses. Papa. To Mrs. Clemens, in Paris. February. Livy dear, last night I played billiards with Mr. Rogers until 11, then went to Robert Reed's studio, and had a most delightful time until 4 this morning. No ladies were invited this time. Among the people present were Coquelin, Richard Harding Davis, Harrison, the great outdoor painter, W.M. H. Chase, the artist, Bettini, inventor of the new phonograph, Nikola Tesla, the worldwide illustrious electrician, see article about him in January or February century, John Drew, actor, James Barnes, a marvelous mimic, my, you should see him, Smedley, the artist, Zorn the artist, Zogbaum the artist, Reinhardt the artist, Metcalf the artist, Ancona, head tenor at the opera. Oh, a great lot of others. Everybody there had done something, and was in his way famous. Somebody welcomed Coquelin in a nice little French speech. John Drew did the like for me in English, and then the fun began. Coquelin did some excellent French monologues, one of them an ungrammatical Englishman telling a colorless historiette in French. It nearly killed the 15 or 20 people who understood it. I told a yarn, Ancona sang half a dozen songs, Barnes did his darling imitations, Harding Davis sang The Hanging of Danny Deever, which was of course good. But he followed it with that most fascinating, for what reason I don't know, of all Kipling's poems, On the Road to Mandalay, sang it tenderly, and it searched me deeper, and charmed me more than the Deever. Young Jarrett Smith played some ravishing dance music and we all danced about an hour. There couldn't be a pleasanter night than that one was. Some of those people complained of fatigue, but I don't seem to know what the sense of fatigue is. Coquelin talks quite good English now. He said, I have a brother who has a fine mind, a charming and delicate fancy, and he knows your writing so well, and loves them, and that is the same with me. It will stir him so, when I write and tell him I have seen you. Wasn't that nice? We talked a good deal together. He is as winning as his own face. But he wouldn't sign that photograph for Clara. Hat? No. She shall have a better one. I will send it to you. He is much driven, and will forget it, but Rita's promised to get the picture for me, and I will try and keep him reminded. Oh, dear, my time is all used up, and your letters are not answered. Mama, dear, I don't go everywhere, I decline most things. But there are plenty that I can't well get out of. I will remember what you say, and not make my yarning too common. I am so glad Susie has gone on that trip, and that you are trying the electric. May you both prosper. For you are mighty dear to me, and in my thoughts always. SAML. The affairs of the Webster Publishing Company were by this time getting into a very serious condition indeed. The effects of the panic of the year before could not be overcome. Creditors were pressing their claims and profits were negligible. In the following letter we get a Mark Twain estimate of the great financier who so cheerfully was willing to undertake the solving of Mark Twain's financial problems. To Mrs. Clemens, in Paris. The Players, February 15, 94. 11. 30 p.m. Livy darling, yesterday I talked all my various matters over with Mr. Rogers and we decided that it would be safe for me to leave here the 7th of March, in the New York. So his private secretary, Miss Harrison, wrote and ordered a berth for me, and then I lost no time in cabling you that I should reach Southampton March 14, and Paris the 15th. Land, but it made my pulses leap. To think I was going to see you again, one thing at a time. I never fully laid Webster's disastrous condition before Mr. Rogers until tonight after billiards. I did hate to burden his good heart, and overworked Ted with it, but he took hold with avidity, and said it was no burden to work for his friends, but a pleasure. We discussed it from various standpoints, and found it a sufficiently difficult problem to solve. But he thinks that, after he has slept upon it, and thought it over, he will know what to suggest. You must not think I am ever rude with Mr. Rogers, I am not. He is not common clay, but fine, fine and delicate, and that sort do not call out the coarsenesses that are in my sort. I am never afraid of wounding him, I do not need to watch myself in that matter. The sight of him is peace. He wants to go to Japan, it is his dream. Wants to go with me, which means the two families, and hear no more about business for a while, and have a rest. And he needs it. But it is like all the dreams of all busy men, fated to remain dreams. You perceive that he is a pleasant text for me. It is easy to write about him. When I arrived in September, Lord, how black the prospect was, how desperate, how incurably desperate. Webster and Company had to have a small sum of money, or go under at once. I flew to Hartford, to my friends, but they were not moved, not strongly interested, and I was ashamed that I went. It was from Mr. Rogers, a stranger, that I got the money, and was by it saved. And then, while still a stranger, he set himself the task of saving my financial life without putting upon me, in his native delicacy, any sense that I was the recipient of a charity, a benevolence, and he has accomplished that task, accomplished it at a cost of 3 months of wearing and difficult labor. He gave that time to me, time which could not be bought by any man at $100,000 a month, no, nor for 3 times the money. Well, in the midst of that great fight, that long and admirable fight, George Warner came to me and said, "There is a splendid chance open to you. I know a man, a prominent man, who has written a book that will go like wildfire, a book that arraigns the Standard Oil fiends, and gives them unmitigated hell, individual by individual. It is the very book for you to publish. There is a fortune in it, and I can put you in communication with the author." I wanted to say, "The only man I care for in the world, the only man I would give a damn for, The only man who is lavishing his sweat and blood to save me and mine from starvation and shame is a Standard Oil fiend. If you know me, you know whether I want the book or not. But I didn't say that. I said I didn't want any book. I wanted to get out of the publishing business, and out of all business, and was here for that purpose, and would accomplish it if I could. But there's enough. I shall be asleep by 3, and I don't need much sleep, because I am never drowsy or tired these days. Dear Susie, my strength reproaches me when I think of her and you, my darling. SAML. But even so able a man as Henry Rogers could not accomplish the impossible. The affairs of the Webster Company were hopeless. The business was not worth saving. By Mr. Rogers' advice, an assignment was made April 18, 1894. After its early spectacular success, less than 10 years had brought the business to failure. The publication of the Grant Memoirs had been its only great achievement. Clemens would seem to have believed that the business would resume, and for a time Rogers appears to have comforted him in his hope, but we cannot believe that it long survived. Young Hall, who had made such a struggle for its salvation, was eager to go on, but he must presently have seen the futility of any effort in that direction. Of course, the failure of Mark Twain's firm made a great stir in the country, and it is easy to understand that loyal friends would rally in his behalf. To Mrs. Clemens, in Paris, April 22, 94. Dear old darling, we all think the creditors are going to allow us to resume business, and if they do, we shall pull through and pay the debts. I am prodigiously glad we made an assignment. And also glad that we did not make it sooner. Earlier we should have made a poor showing, but now we shall make a good one. I meet flocks of people, and they all shake me cordially by the hand, and say, "Was so sorry to hear of the assignment, but so glad you did it." It was around this long time that the concern was tottering, and all your friends were afraid you would delay the assignment too long. John McKay called yesterday and said, "Don't let it disturb you, Sam. We all have to do it at one time or another. It's nothing to be ashamed of." One stranger out in New York State sent me a dollar bill and thought he would like to get up a dollar subscription for me. And Pulteney Bigelow's note came promptly with his check for $1,000. I had been meeting him every day at the club and liking him better and better all the time. I couldn't take his money, of course, but I thanked him cordially for his goodwill. Now and then a good and dear Joe Twitchell or Susie Warner condoles with me and says, "Hear up, don't be downhearted," and some other friend says, "I am glad and surprised to see how cheerful you are and how bravely you stand it," and none of them suspect what a burden has been lifted from me and how blithe I am inside. Except when I think of you, dear heart, then I am not blithe. For I seem to see you grieving and ashamed, and dreading to look people in the face. For in the thick of the fight there is cheer, but you are far away, and cannot hear the drums, nor see the wheeling squadrons. You only seem to see rout, retreat, and dishonored colors dragging in the dirt, whereas none of these things exist. There is temporary defeat, but no dishonor, and we will march again. Charlie Warner said today, "Show, Livy isn't worrying. So long as she's got you and the children, she doesn't care what happens. She knows it isn't her affair," which didn't convince me. Goodbye, my darling. I love you and all of the kids, and you can tell Claire I am not a spitting gray kitten. SAML. Clemens sailed for Europe as soon as his affairs would permit him to go. He must get settled where he could work comfortably. Type-setter prospects seemed promising, but meantime there was need of funds. He began writing on the ship, as was his habit, and had completed his article on Fenimore Cooper by the time he reached London. In August we find him writing to Mr. Rogers from Etretat, a little Norman watering place. To H.H. Rogers, in New York. Etretat, Normandy, Chalet des Abris, August 25, 94. Dear Mr. Rogers, I find the Madam Ever so much better in health and strength. The air is superb and soothing and wholesome, and the chalet is remote from noise and people, and just the place to write in. I shall begin work this afternoon. Mrs. Clemens is in great spirits on account of the benefit which she has received from the electrical treatment in Paris, and is bound to take it up again, and continue it all the winter, and of course I am perfectly willing. She requires me to drop the lecture platform out of my mind, and go straight ahead with Joan until the book is finished. If I should have to go home for even a week, she means to go with me won't consent to be separated again, but she hopes I won't need to go. I tell her all right, I won't go unless you send, and then I must. She keeps the accounts, and as she ciphers it, we can't get crowded for money for 8 months yet. I didn't know that. But I don't know much anyway. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. The reader may remember that Clemens had written the first half of his Joan of Arc book at the Villa Viviani, in Florence, nearly 2 years before. He had closed the manuscript then with the taking of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.